Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Margaret Keck, and I represent Colorado Springs Health Partners and American Compensation Insurance in this workers' compensation matter. I'd like to start with just a very brief summary of the facts in this case. And I will refer to the parties as the claimant, Ms. Silvera, and respondents, my clients, because that's how I refer to them in the brief. Ms. Silvera, the claimant, she was awarded workers' compensation benefits for an occupational disease consisting of latex hypersensitivity. And her disease developed over time. And during that time, her employer was insured by different workers' compensation carriers. Litigation ensued over which of two potential insurers was liable for Ms. Silvera's occupational disease. And it was ultimately determined that the respondent insurer here today, American Compensation Insurance Company, was the liable insurer based upon a section of the statutes 841-3042, which states that the employer in whose employment the claimant was last injuriously exposed to the hazards of the disease and the employer's insurance carrier on the risk at the time of the last exposure is liable for the workers' compensation benefits. So American Compensation Insurance Company paid Ms. Silvera's indemnity medical benefits over time, and this case was eventually closed on November 9th of 2005, except for medical maintenance benefits. And medical maintenance benefits remained open. Claimant's employer became insured by a different carrier in 2008. Ms. Silvera continued treating, or I should say Dr. Silvera continued treating for her latex hypersensitivity in 2008 and 2009. In occupational disease cases, liability for medical benefits is treated differently than indemnity benefits. Under the World Globe insurance case, which is cited in the briefs, the insurance carrier on the risk at the time the medical expenses are incurred is liable for payment of those expenses. And then case law goes on to further say that the insurer on the risk is the insurer that provided coverage to the employer whose conditions of employment caused the need for treatment. Under this Royal Globe case, it's therefore possible for one insurer to be liable for indemnity benefits and another insurer to be liable for medical benefits. So when the insurer on the risk changed in 2008, the current respondent insurer, American Compensation Insurance Company, applied for a hearing in 2010 on the issue of medical benefits, contending that it was no longer the insurer on the risk. And while it appeared, based upon the medical bills, that Dr. Silvera continued to treat for hypersensitivity, the respondent needed to prove that the need for the treatment was the result of the exposure that occurred after the insurers changed. Respondent attempted to get Ms. Dr. Silvera's medical records, but were unsuccessful in this attempt. The respondent therefore sought to either postpone the hearing or to cancel it altogether until they could obtain the medical records. But Dr. Silvera's attorney objected to canceling the hearing, and the administrative law judge required the respondent to proceed with the hearing. The administrative law judge accepted the jurisdiction and made a finding of fact that the insurer had changed in 2008, but he also granted the claimant's motion for a directed verdict due to a lack of evidence.
Can I back up there, Ms. Kecker, let me interrupt you if I may, because I think you're making an assumption that seems to me to be very important in the case, and that's exactly what was the hearing sought for. You have said, and I know it's your position, that the hearing was sought to determine whether the old insurer was the insurer on the risk or not. As I understand it, the ALJ seemed to think, no, that's not the question you designated at all. It was a whole different issue about whether, if this happens in the future, you could possibly be liable. That's why the agency thought that this, or the panel thought that this was speculative, because we don't know. We'll have to take one case at a time. So I think there's two different questions. You have a pretty strong argument if what you actually set up for hearing was, am I the insurer on the risk or not? It's a different question if it's what the way the panel perceived it. So could you address that procedural question? I recognize the form has its limitations and all that, but it's difficult to see a clear statement when this hearing was set that it was, the question presented was, who's the insurer on the company on the risk?
Sure. Well, you know, there is no rule in the form at all for this particular issue. It just doesn't exist. The most that we have is medical benefits. That form is extremely limited in nature. And so what happened was, is eventually, the hearing was set after the attorney for respondents had consulted with the attorney for Dr. Silvera. And then they actually went to the hearing. And at the hearing, the attorney for respondents did say what the issue was, and she did specifically state it was a Royal Globe issue. And then Judge Walsh, the administrative law judge, cited that as the issue he was deciding. And I quoted Judge Walsh in the brief, saying Judge Walsh recognized what the issue was, and he said so. And as I said, I quoted that in the brief. So no one was under the impression that the issue was anything different than what I just said, which is the Royal Globe case. No one was under the impression there were some other kind of medical benefits at issue. Claimant's counsel knew prior to the hearing, the judge knew at the hearing, and it was briefed subsequent to the hearing, and the issue always was the Royal Globe issue. It wasn't any other kind of medical benefit. So the respondents notified claimant of the issue itself within the context of the application for hearing as much as that form allowed the respondents to give such notice. Much more complete notice was subsequently given after consultation with claimant's counsel and with the judge. And I think the judge recognized that. I think the ultimate conversation that later on discussed about whether this was some sort of declaratory judgment action on the part of the respondents was simply claimant's counsel arguing to the judge that this is in effect what the respondents had done. And the respondents had not done that. The judge, I think, became confused by the argument that somehow a deck action was involved in this. The deck action might, you can't maintain a deck action if you're talking about a speculative injury that might occur in the future. But that was never what this case was about. This case was about whether the insurer or the employer had in fact changed, whether Dr. Silvera continued to be exposed to latex on the job, whether that exposure continued to cause her need for medical treatment. None of this was a speculative injury that might occur in the future. These were the facts that the respondents hoped to prove at the time they went to hearing. So what we ultimately had was a lack of enough evidence to prove their case, but nevertheless, that was the case that the respondents were proceeding to on the hearing. I think when you look at the Industrial Claims Appellate Office order, it's a little bit hard to discern exactly what their rationale is, but they clearly seem to confuse the concept of a lack of ripeness with a lack of substantial justification. The panel awarded attorney's fees to the claimant in this case based upon the respondent's inability to prove their case. But there's no authority to award attorney's fees under these circumstances. So instead, the panel characterized the respondent's inability to prove their case as a lack of ripeness. I think they just got it wrong. Normally under American jurisprudence, each party pays their own attorney's fees, but there are some exceptions, and clearly there's some exceptions in Colorado. And a primary one in Colorado is that attorney's fees can be awarded when a claim lacks substantial justification, or in other words, is essentially groundless or frivolous. But this exception only applies in civil litigation under Section 1317.102 sub 4. The Workers' Compensation Act used to have almost identical statute, but the General Assembly repealed that statute in 1996. The General Assembly manifested a clear intent not to award attorney's fees for cases that lack substantial justification.
Ms. Keck, let me just ask, because I know you're characterizing the court's order as being really one for lack of substantial justification, but the court was very clear in its characterization itself as this being a rightness issue, and also saying, looking at this case now in this light, I agree it's not ripe, but what it's referring back to in finding that the case was not proven, I don't know that it stated then that it lacked justification. It just said the case had not been proven. So what are you looking at in saying that this really was about lack of substantial justification or groundlessness?
I'm looking at the language used both by the administrative law judge, and when you say the court, were you referring to the industrial?
Yes, I'm sorry, panel? Yes. Mm-hmm.
They use language like there's a lack of a factual basis. What does that mean? That means a lack of evidence.
They said a lack of a factual basis to indicate an actual controversy, I think was the sentence, if I remember, I'm going from memory. So that, I think there's a different, I understand the argument you're making. If they just said you didn't have any evidence or your evidence didn't prove it, that would be one thing. But I think they were saying there wasn't a factual basis to indicate a live controversy here. That does sound like ripeness, but respond.
But there was a factual, there was a controversy because the insurer had changed and the administrative law judge found that the insurer had changed. There were medical bills that were submitted in evidence showing that Dr. Silvera continued to treat for latex hypersensitivity. So there was, and the respondent specifically said, we don't think, or respondent insurer said, we don't think we are the liable insurer anymore because there is a new insurer who is on the risk at the time the treatment is being necessitated by the claimant's exposure to allergens.
But does there also have to be evidence of kind of a new injury or a renewed injury? In other words, if she's still suffering the same latex issue that she had before, the first insurer would remain on the risk, I think.
No, I just respectfully disagree with that analysis.
Please, that's fine.
I think the Royal Globe case makes it, well, it might be somewhat of an undecided question, but the Royal Globe case certainly seems to say that the insurer on the risk at the time the treatment is incurred is an insurer that's liable, which means, and it has been found in the past, that sometimes you have a different insurer liable for the medical benefits as compared to the insurer liable for the indemnity benefits. Because for indemnity, the insurer that's held liable initially is always the insurer on the risk, is always liable for indemnity, but that's not the same for medical benefits. If I may, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
You have 3 minutes and 43 seconds.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Mullins. I represent Dr. Silvera. Dr. Silvera is a family practitioner. She maintains almost 4,000 patient caseload at the Colorado Springs Medical Center. She developed an allergy to latex exposure in her work as a family physician. In 2003, Judge Stuber issued a final order finding that Dr. Silvera had a fully developed allergy to latex, and in his first order that was issued in January 23, 2003, Judge Stuber stated that the respondents, American Insurance, was obligated to pay for all of Dr. Silvera's reasonable, necessary, and related medical care from 2000 and continuing. She was clearly awarded what are known to be Grover medical benefits in the jargon of workers' compensation. So, in this case, the respondents, American, failed to endorse issues that were ripe at the time of application. And with all due respect to counsel, the issues that she has just suggested were the issues before the court were not the issues. The issues before the administrative law judge at the hearing that produced this appeal were, number one, did respondents fail to list issues that were ripe in their application for hearing in March of 2010, and two, if they did list issues that were not ripe, was claimant entitled to attorney's fees and costs? The next issue that's been endorsed by cross appeal is claimant's request for the award fees and costs all the way through the life of the application that respondent American Insurance filed, and I'll get back to that in a minute. By failing to endorse issues that were ripe in this case, American Insurance clearly implicated Civil Rule 19. They failed to identify an indispensable party to the process below. There's been a claim and even a statement today that there was a different insurance company on the risk, but there's never been any evidence of what insurance company. There's never been a single document offered. There's not one drop of testimony in the record to support the suggestion or the argument that there was a change in coverage, so as to the statement or the conclusion that is offered by my worthy opponent about a change in coverage, that never was established. But more importantly, under Rule 19B, the new insurance company would have been indispensable to the resolution of the declaratory relief that Americans sought, if declaratory relief is available in workers' comp. I respectfully submit that the Workers' Comp Act is a creature of statute, it's a derogation of common law, and declaratory actions are not available in workers' compensation proceedings. A party can go to district court and request declaratory relief pertaining to a work comp claim, but within the confines and the life of the work comp claim itself, before the Workers' Comp Administrative Law Judge, there is no such remedy, there is no such availability of declaratory action relief. And more importantly, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
More importantly, in this case, because the suggested but unidentified new insurance company was never made a party, never any proof of coverage, and was never identified in any way in this case, that created a legal impediment to proceeding on the application for hearing, even assuming that there had been other real immediate issues to decide, and there weren't. But that legal impediment under the Oliva-Soto case that's referred to in the briefs constitutes an individual standalone basis for determining a lack of ripeness.
May I ask you a question about this legal impediment? I believe in reading the briefs, the opposing counsel stated that they didn't necessarily need to show who the new coverage was provided by, just that they alone had ceased to provide coverage.
I
was just going to ask you to respond to that.
Sure. That suggestion, if you take it to its logical conclusion, would mean that if American was successful on this application, Dr. Silvera, who had been a beneficiary of a final order declaring her entitlement to medical benefits, would have been left without coverage of any kind. In defiance of Judge Stuber's order that continued in full force in effect, and the conclusion that you have to reach is that respondents' position that they don't have to identify the new or substituted carrier really constitutes little more than a collateral, successful illegal collateral attack on Judge Stuber's final order, and that's not contemplated by the Act. There were a lot of different ways they could have gotten from here to there and attempted to achieve the result they wanted, but listing issues that were not ripe is not one of them.
Mr. Mullins, while we stopped you, can you address what is your understanding of the issues they did list? And along those lines, if you would respond to Ms. Keck's argument that at the beginning of the hearing they said this is a Royal Globe issue, and I think there was at least referenced in the briefs that there was at least a couple of medical documents in evidence. I recognize they didn't get other ones they wanted. So what's your understanding of the issues that were endorsed here?
They endorsed, and I'm looking at a copy of their application for hearing that's in the record. They endorsed the issues of compensability, reasonably necessary, and related to injury under medical benefits. They endorsed under other issues, they have an X in the box, and there's simply a statement, and I'll quote the statement. American Compensation Insurance has not insured Colorado Springs Health Partners for this occupational disease since July 2007. Ms. Keck today tells you it's 2008. I understand the confusion because there was no record whatsoever below as to when a new insurance carrier came in, if ever. But those were the only issues endorsed. And at the outset of proceedings before Judge Walsh, the attorney who represented American, Ms. Tyler, not Ms. Keck, informed the judge that she was not going to proceed on any medical benefits. And indeed, there was no basis for her to proceed on medical benefits. There were no bills at issue. There were no procedures that American was contesting. There were no identified medical issues before the court that were the subject of any contest. And if you take a look at finding of fact 12 that Judge Walsh offered in his corrected findings of fact and order, you really get in a hurry to the issue before the court. In Judge Walsh's finding number 12, he noted that Ms. Tyler argued that she wanted medical releases so that she could find out information about medical benefits. These are the medical benefits that they filed an application for. So what you have, as clearly inferred by Judge Walsh's finding, is American filed an application first and then tried to figure out if there was something they could fight about in court after. They came to court without any medical contest, which is what the administrative court system is about. They came to court without a single medical bill to dispute, without a single procedure to raise a question about. So there were no real issues before the court that were documented and therefore real, and there was nothing immediate about the issue. And those are two of the prongs of the Oliva-Soto decision. The third prong is a fit for adjudication. And it's the fit for adjudication where they totally went off the tracks because they failed to bring in an indispensable party under Rule 19. That would have been whoever this imagined or new insurance company is. And if I may, under Rule 19, it is stated in subsection B, the factors to be considered in determining what to do about indispensable parties. And one of the first criteria is, and I quote, first, to what extent a judgment rendered in the person's absence might be prejudicial to him or those already parties. So to come full circle on the question that was asked by Justice Lichtenstein, the net effect of deciding anything pursuant to this application that had nothing but unripe issues would have been to severely prejudice Dr. Silveria by a determination that somehow, for some reason, completely unproven, American Insurance, who was the subject of Judge Stuber's final order, was somehow magically no longer liable to provide the benefits that Judge Stuber ordered American to pay, with no identification as to who was out there that was going to provide the benefits. This is a twofold or threefold problem. Number one, American comes in claiming to represent its own interests and that of the employer. So let's go to the first example. Let's assume there is no new insurance company, and if there is one, we don't know who it is. But if there is none, then Colorado Springs Health Partners is not only stuck to personally pay without having the benefit of reasonable representation and a duty of loyalty exercised by the insurance company on the risk, the employer also potentially stands to pay a 50% penalty on benefits because they are now, as a matter of law, non-insured. Two, Dr. Silveria is totally left without the benefits that were guaranteed by Judge Stuber. And three, you have a rather formidable conflict of interest, I think, on the part of counsel representing both American and Colorado Springs Health Partners, choosing between one or the other in terms of interest. But I digress.
I've stopped, Mr. Mons, and I do understand everything you said. I want to go back just briefly.
Sure.
Ms. Toller say at the beginning of the, I think you were the trial lawyer, if I remember.
Yes, I was.
Did Ms. Toller say that at the beginning of the hearing this was a Royal Globe issue? And if so, what did you understand that to mean?
She argued that there was a Royal Globe issue and then misquoted from Royal Globe. Royal Globe itself had raised the issue of last injurious exposure. It primarily addressed underground mining activities where the mining operators used to stand in a circle and say, he didn't get silicosis here, it's this guy, and so on and so forth. So there was a body of law that was codified in the statute for the last injurious exposure if you had one of these disease cases. And that later became adopted in repetitive action or motion disorder cases that can, under the right circumstances, shift the burden to pay for medical to a subsequent carrier. But none of that matters here. None of those issues are relevant to your decision in this case, because your decision in this case is whether at the time of the application, not at any time subsequent, but at the time of the application were the issues endorsed unripe for hearing. And for all of these reasons, there was a complete failure on the part of American Insurance to list issues that were ripe. I'd like to note that this is a huge apple, if you want to use the metaphor. And American had eight different chances, eight different bites at this apple to get this right and stop this. Their first chance was with a phone call from their attorney when I called her about what have you filed this application for? And then they filed the second amended application. That's already in the record. The second was when they filed the second app and decided to go full steam ahead. The third was when we had a pre-hearing before Judge Purdy, and Judge Purdy characterized this effort to simply shift liability for medical benefits without naming another insurance company. She characterized that suggestion as crazy. with all due respect. The fourth opportunity, or fourth bite at the apple, was the hearing we had on June 15th, 2010. They could have walked away from this then and decided to just take their lumps as to the issues that were not ripe and simply paid the fees and cost at that point. Not good enough. 61 days transpired. They request no relief by motion. They did not address this case in any way. And on August 26th, we completed the hearing. That was our fifth opportunity, our fifth bite at the apple. Sixth, there was an order issued to pay. Instead of just paying the order and making this madness go away, they decided to appeal. So then we went to ICAO. ICAO is the seventh bite at the apple, and this court is the eighth. I mention these eight chances and these eight bites at the apple because I think it segues nicely into why this court should grant attorneys fees and costs all the way through the life of this case. This is not a matter of a 10-minute or 2-hour or 3-hour effort. This has been intense. It's been long. The American is entitled and has worked very hard at the entitlement to pay these fees and costs. And this statute was created to discourage placing into motion workers' compensation hearings that really aren't ready to be heard, that really are not ripe, that are not fit to be adjudicated, and to discourage that activity. And this case stands as the poster child example as to why that statute should be enforced all the way through the life of the appeal. And I think that awarding the fees and costs in that manner is clearly consistent with case law that I've cited in the brief.
Mr. Lowe, I guess the issue I have, you make a compelling argument and a strong equitable argument. The problem I'm faced with as an appellate judge is the language of the statute. It says, if you endorse an issue not ripe, such person shall be assessed the reasonable fees and cost of the opposing party in preparing for such hearing or setting. Your argument is compelling, but the legislature was pretty specific on when we can award fees and what for.
If you take a look at the Young case, that I know this court is familiar with, and it's included in the brief, it awarded the fees and costs through the entire appellate process, including up through the Supreme Court of the United States. So there's precedent for making this award, and there's other case law in similar situations that this court, this honorable court, has already ruled upon, where that equitable argument has been translated into a right that's by way of statutory interpretation and granted, so that this order of filing unripe issues is thoroughly discouraged.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins. All right, Ms. Keck, you have 3 minutes and 43 seconds remaining.
The fact remains that the issues that were endorsed in the application for hearing were issues that were understood by everyone to be Royal Globe. Even though it didn't say Royal Globe in the application for a hearing, the attorney for respondents consulted with Mr. Mullins prior to the hearing. The attorney at the hearing for respondents stated what the issue was. It was Royal Globe, and Judge Walsh repeated that as the issue. Throughout the course of the hearing, Mr. Mullins then chose to characterize this as some sort of action for declaratory relief. That's never how the respondents characterized it, and then, in fact, it was not a request for declaratory relief. It was simply how Mr. Mullins chose to characterize it to the judge, and the judge accepted that in terms of saying that there was no issue ripe for hearing, even though the judge had just ruled on the issue that was set for hearing, which was the medical benefits issue, whether the respondents were liable for continuing medical benefits based upon the Royal Globe case. How can the judge, on the one hand, say, I am finding for the claimant, I am granting the motion for directed verdict, the respondents failed to prove their case, and then turn around and say, I don't have jurisdiction. The issue is not right, therefore I'm awarding attorney's fees. What he did was fundamentally inconsistent.
But Ms. Keck, what would you have had to prove to win on the quote-unquote Royal Globe issue? And forgive my ignorance, but I may just not be understanding, and you seem to be talking past each other on what the Royal Globe issue means. What would you have had to prove to win that?
What we would have had to prove to win that was that Dr. Silvera continued to require medical treatment for latex hypersensitivity, that the need for that treatment was a result of her continued employment with the respondent employer, and that the respondent employer's insurer had changed at some point in time. The employer became insurer became a new insurer, while Dr. Silver was still being exposed to a toxic substance and was still requiring medical treatment.
Right, so if you, and I gather your position is, you essentially admit you didn't have the evidence for that because you were denied it, you tried to get it, correct?
We didn't have enough evidence. The respondents did have evidence that she was treating. They did have evidence that the insurer had changed. And Judge Walsh found, as a finding of fact, that the insurer had changed. So that's in his order, and that has never been contested. So
but the first prong that you said you didn't have evidence for, and I think Mr. Mullins is saying, you don't know that you have an issue yet because you don't even have any inkling that you have that evidence.
We did have the evidence. We just didn't have enough evidence. We had evidence that she was treating. We had evidence that she's still having problems with allergy. We had evidence that the carrier had changed. We knew for a fact the carrier changed, and the judge accepted that and put that in his finding of fact. The only prong that we weren't able to prove was sufficiency was whether or not she was continuing to be exposed to latex allergens at the time there's a new insurer on the risk. We knew that she was still treating, so it sure looked like she's being continuing to be exposed to those allergens on the job. We didn't know. That's why we needed the medical records. We needed to see what the medical records stated in terms of her exposure, when it occurred. Was it before or after the new insurer came on the risk? And that was what Ms. Starlet tried to get, were those medical records so that she could prove the ultimate prong of the case. But there's certainly a dispute. As soon as the insurer changed, that created the dispute. Even if we couldn't prove all the other elements, that dispute was there.
But let me just ask a follow-up question, because I believe there were findings regarding aggravation of the injury. And so was that a requisite, or was it just showing a continued exposure?
No, I believe, trying to remember the language in the Royal Globe case, I believe it just had to be, there had to be a continuing exposure on the job, so that the continuing exposure caused her to continue to need treatment for the hypersensitivity.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments, and the case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.